Welcome back to episode, I think this is episode six, five or six of the Hero Mindset podcast, and where we talk about hope, efficacy, resilience, and optimism, the capital, the psychological capital that we need to improve individual and organizational performance. And I have a great guest today. His name is William. Help me say your last name, William. I've never said it, so I don't.
Mackalia. William Mackalia.
William Mackalia. He's a colleague of mine. He's a senior PhD intern in a practice that I'm affiliated with as a student. And we're glad to have him because he's a veteran. But not only that, he has a lot of experience. I'm sure he'll tell us as a CEO. And in the healthcare industry, he's a very, very adept therapist and burgeoning psychologist. He's very great. It's a pleasure to work with him. So welcome, William. Tell us a little about yourself and what you got going on.
Well, thanks, TJ. I appreciate the welcome. Fourth year clinical doctoral student in clinical psychology, finishing up dissertation, probably here this fall, alongside internship. Currently a licensed hypnotherapist, and I do therapy several times a week. Anybody who may be interested out there, a lot of veterans with PTSD, trauma-informed care. We also make sure that we all, you know, just taking in consideration the things that people have gone through before we do those types of modalities. Background is a CEO. Was in long-term care for about 15 years as a licensed nursing home administrator, overseeing various long-term care facilities. One notable was I was the superintendent of the Washington Veterans Home in Port Orchard, Washington. During COVID-19.
Wow.
Just a little bit of my background. Yeah.
So one thing that stuck out to me there is your experience during COVID-19, and you're running this veterans home in Washington. Tell us a little about that. What did you learn about resiliency? How to get through? I mean, what most people thought were pretty catastrophic times.
Well, when you say resilience, that would probably be the epitome of resilience. during COVID, man, it was a 24/7, 365 operation, operating on very little sleep. 256 bed skilled long-term care facility, bigger than most hospitals. And, you know, within the state. And, you know, we were dealing with something that we had never seen before as a nation. In the state of Washington, there was a big push for everybody to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Mm-hmm. And from the state and federal level, a lot of the nurses were, you know, not wanting to, which was their choice. And so we were down on people, down on staff, down on our census in terms of, you know, people not wanting to come into nursing homes for fear of death because of the scare surrounding COVID-19 itself. But the business aspect still very much was at hand, you know, because profits declined, the less veterans we can help and potentially have to close the facility. So as the superintendent, you got to figure out ways to make money without both of those things. So it became very interesting, not only from the money perspective, but still also have that empathetic desire to help all of these veterans as well.
If you can share with us, what are some of the ideas that you came with to be successful during this time?
That's a great question. It took a couple of weeks for me to fully grasp my SWOT analysis, my strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats in terms of what we had going on within the facility, getting the proper PPE sent in to, and also just the structural base had to change because we had people who weren't infected, we had people who were infected. So closing down several halls where we would place the infected people. Also, I'm trying not to cross-contaminate. So there was a lot of that there. But also then looking into dynamics of what could I do to continue to bolster census, bringing people in. So we had a lot of service-connected veterans that still needed assistance. We had a long waiting list. And the reimbursement rates for that was significantly high in that area. So we just welcomed them in, make sure that they were put in a place where they were still safe, thus increasing the census. And then we did have to hire out for state assistance in terms of more staffing to assist as well. So by doing both, we were helping ourselves grow as a business, also while helping veterans, but also while keeping them safe. So it was a multidisciplinary approach, but also, I mean, saying it, it sounds easy, but it was very complex in nature.
Yeah, it sounds like it was, well, I mean, it was a novel situation that's changed the landscape. And I think you see that in terms of it's permanently changed how we are doing business today, how we're interacting with one another. I think you see that everything seems these days atypical. You read the Wall Street Journal and the late, the market's up, the labor, section of the economy is kind of, slowly progressing, but in times before, all these things represented like very tough times, financially across the board in terms of the market, the economy. But we don't see that today. We see, what I like to say is, we see people, we see sectors, things thriving in spite of, and that's, you're telling your story, and that's kind of what that reminds me of. You have to find a, you found a way to thrive, based upon the op, what we would say in the army, the operational environment, right? And I think that's key because life happens, and I mean, significant catastrophic things happen. I'm sure that your situation with COVID experiences that I was at the time, I was at Fort Huachuca and in the regional cyber center, and I was the operations NCOIC as mass sergeant at the time, and you talked about closing down rooms and sections. Well, we had to figure out how we were going to continue to protect our battle space, which was the United States, the continental United States, and still get people in and out. So we got with public health and we figured out, how can we just played the what if game. We war gamed every, so to speak, every possible scenario that could happen. And then we created, teams and essentially ended up having to hold group, we had groups that didn't come into work just in case the worst case scenario happened.
Yeah,
And
it was pretty much the same. Very much so. I didn't say that earlier. 10 years prior service Army, Airborne Ranger. But also a lot of those things that we did and accomplished throughout our military objectives, definite, it's crazy. You think that none of those things that you're going through in life you'll ever utilize again. But I very much utilized a lot of the same principles, practices, and strategies that I did in wartime environment. And so it was very strategic in the terms of numbers of beds that we used, and we increased them gradually if needed it. or set or tapered down if needed, and making sure all the contamination or decontamination phases happen per CDC guidelines. You know, it was a real tumultuous time, and constantly getting updates daily, if not multiple times a day, from the CDC and, you know, what their recommendations were, different forms of PPE, specific clothing that could and could not be worn. And everyone had some level of being anxious, nervous, and scared at that time because, well, if they had it, and, you know, there was a fear that when you had it, you were going to die. But there wasn't a lot of information out there to the community. And if it was, it was hearsay. And so, you know, fast forward 5, 6 years later, and it's a lot different from, you know, what we know now than what we knew back then.
Yeah, I think that's, it reminds me, and we heard this a lot through, our military careers. I remember hearing it a lot in, during my deployments, especially the early ones to Iraq. And, they would say you have to push through the kill zone. In fact, we at first, when we would encounter fire, we'd be on a convoy or what was then called a convoy. We later called it a patrol, I think, is, we would stop and, we would return, we'd take a position and we, you return fire or whatever. And we soon learned that you can't, you have to push through the kill zone. If a vehicle gets disabled, you grab it, you pull it along behind you, or you dismount and get in, put people or equipment into other vehicles. And you, because at that point, all of the enemy's resources are concentrated against you. And when you, if you stop, it's harder to get that, to get going again and to gain that momentum to be successful. It's very, that's what's resonating with me when I hear
Being
you
in that
tell your
environment,
story.
those situations definitely forge leadership in the most unconventional ways. And being the leader by my position was different from being a leader by my actions. Being, you know, always there, 20-hour days, sometimes I just slept at the facility, and consistently giving the team a hand in areas where they need short. You know, being the CEO or superintendent, I was still helping wash dishes or make beds, you name it. I mean, sometimes you lead from the back as well as the front.
Yeah, I think that's, what I found something similar was that sometimes as the you have the most flexibility, right? Because to step in and help in those areas that if you didn't, you'd have to take technical experts, physicians, nurses, therapists, whatever, away from doing what they needed to do. And you definitely you don't want that. You
But you
want
know,
your
sometimes
resources
people's
concentrated.
ego get in the way, or that out that level of power gets to their head. And I can say that during that time, none of that existed. It was all just about, like, very much a team-like atmosphere,
Yeah.
because we were all going through something together, and so we felt like a team by default, regardless of any issues that people may have had. Maybe outside of work or what they may be going with through with their families. And it was just real. It was just a real tough, but team-like environment during that time.
Yeah, it's that shared adversity, everybody's hyper focused on, on an objective, and we're less distracted by all the other noise. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think that in contemporary society today, we're missing a lot of that shared adversity that our parents
For
and our
sure.
grandparents experience living through, well, my grandparents were born during the Depression, 1930, 32, in the South, and they experienced the Depression as young kids. And then so about, 10, during their teen years, they experienced World War II. Then my grandfather went to Korea with a brand new, didn't even know my mother. My mother was born while he was in Korea. And then, they lived through all those things, and that shared, keeps you focused. That shared adversity, keeps you focused, but you're not so, but it's not so much so that you become like anxious, like, well, as we see people clinically that are clinically anxious and just kind of always worried about what's going to happen if the shoe, the next problem ever manifests, right? But it kept them focused, and they were able to push through. And I see that as a problem today. I think we've forgotten how to block out the noise and work towards a common goal. What do you, as in terms of your clinical practice, what do you, and I know you see veterans, you work with people that have addiction. What do you see? What's the biggest issue you believe facing our veteran community?
You know, TJ, that hits home, man. It was the reason why I chose to go back to school for another 4 or 5 years to become a clinical psychologist.
Yeah, and spend
So,
$200,000.
you know, sometimes when you're in that fight and you feel like the resources aren't there for the veterans, those of us who are veterans feel it as well. And so, to answer the question, in short, it would be resources. Because here I was, at the pinnacle of my career at that time. There was nowhere else to go in terms of climbing a corporate ladder. I had told myself that this was my dream job at one point, and I can remember the tiny voice in the back of my mind saying that you needed to dream bigger. Your dream is bigger. And I'll never stop helping veterans to, to my last breath. And so it just became more of be the change that you want to be in the world. And so I definitely decided to go back to school, become a clinical psychologist to help veterans specifically with mental health, because I was surrounded by 250 plus veterans per day and just seeing all of the things that they were going through. And we could never have enough physicians or, in-house to actually see all of them. So it just became my personal personal goal, I guess.
Yeah, that I have a sim. I think that's amazing, because it is a resource issue. And if you, I would imagine, just off the top of my head, that the population you were dealing with, you had a probably a large Vietnam veteran population or people that served around that time. You might have had even some Korean War veterans,
Sure, all of them.
the few World War II veterans that are left. But you look at that, that Vietnam veteran population, and they were, as my uncle said one time when I came home, and he threw me this big celebration, and he says, nobody did this for me, so I wanted to do it for you. And they didn't, you're dealing with a population that didn't have the support of the American people, that was the last of the draftees, probably. I mean, and it's and they that you know that we had never experienced that type of warfare before, and that It wasn't even, I don't even know if irregular is the word to use, because it was, because irregular warfare means something, else. This was, this was, we were fighting against people who had been fighting for years on their own territory. And so my point is sometimes things, the what we see, the our experiences, they don't manifest till much later. We think things are okay in terms of PTSD. We think it's, that being irritable all the time and not wanting to go places and being socially isolated, it's just how things are because we served. And so my story is, I got into psychology. I've loved it for forever and passionate about it, because if you can master your mind, you can become the master of your destiny, is how I looked at it, right? But then I was doing organizational psychology for a while, and then in August of 2023, I got a phone call 2 weeks before he retired. A good friend of mine, Frank Estrada, committed suicide, and he and there was no rhyme or reason. He was, they used to always tell you, ask care escort, or if Will's or TJ's, William or TJ's feeling suicidal, they're probably going to give their stuff away and they're going to be sad. And he was going to conferences. He kept appointments with his
Sure.
commander. He was doing everything. Went to his kid's birthday party, came home that Saturday, walked out into the garage and hung himself. And so instantly then, and this is the subject of my dissertation, this thought, became the basis of my dissertation. It was, how does somebody get to the point where they can manually override all the systems in their body that are meant to ensure survival? And I said, then how does somebody get to the point where they can, it's not like, he took some sleeping pills. He hung himself, and Frank was not a small guy, so this took some calculation. And then I started learning that that first 12 months, or that period approaching somebody getting out, is the most, is statistically the most challenging time. You might say deadly time for veterans. And being able to do some research into that and to look and to see how that has affected their self, getting out affects your self identity, ego, right? Because our ego is heavily associated. I mean, we, you think of somebody in the military and they have a uniform on and the rank. And so, our ego, or who we're projecting
We tend
ourselves
to
to be.
identify with that. As men, we tend to identify with that a lot.
You tend to identify with that. And so then I was like, you know what? I'm going to quit BSing. I'm going to pursue, if I'm paying all this money, I'm going to pursue what I'm passionate about. And that's what I'm going to do.
Right.
And, like $200,000 here, later, here I am. And I love it. I'll tell you that, going into this has not been like going through basic training again. And I think I told you when I met you, like on day one, hey, I'm like a private. I know nothing. I'm a sponge. I need to be a sponge. I don't know anything. It's really an adult learning model as you're going through this and you're seeing these people, and you're trying to fit, how can you, help them. And then at the same time, especially in terms of my journey, and I haven't, shared this too publicly, but I'll share it now, as and in the process of this, I was diagnosed with severe PTSD. And I started to have, then I started realizing, oh, you mean the constant fidgeting, the bouncing my leg, not being able to be still, always hyper, concerned about what's going to happen next. And I mean, it's like, this isn't normal. I thought this was normal because of the constant, just especially as I got to the more senior ranks, Master Sergeant, Sergeant Major, there's a ton of pressure on you, and it's kind of like you become used to it, right? And what makes me wonder is how many other people think that, this is normal, and they just have to, it's just something they have to learn to accept. And I tell you, my own journey has led me to understand that you can, you're never going to get over it. And you're always going, you have to, it's a constant, you have to will, you have to push, yourself through it, but you don't have to feel like your hair's on fire every day.
Well, you said something that caught my attention, and it was being diagnosed with PTSD. As you know, many other people may know who may be going through PTSD or feel like they have PTSD. PTSD standing for post-traumatic stress disorder. One of the main symptoms is depression. And when, if anybody has went through depression, you can kind of understand that your mind isn't all there. Things that you would normally be able to think about, it doesn't come as rapid. Or the motivation to do something isn't there. Or sometimes your recall in your mind, you just can't come up with it. It's like your brain has a virus. And if your brain was a computer and had a has a this virus, it's like it's infected. It's not able to process at its full potential speed. And it's sort of how the depression sort of works within PTSD. And as we go through this these different phases of our life while still having that PTSD, it's like you're not even the same person. And so anybody out there with PTSD who may need help, there is help available. You could always call 988, 911, seek counseling, or reach out to a mental health professional. That's what we're here for. A lot of us wear a different suit these days, but still carry those patches of veteran brotherhood with us. And so we are here to help in various forms. It just
Absolutely.
takes that emotionalized desire to reach out.
And I'll tell you another thing, and in my case, and of course hindsight's always 20, 2020, is things present differently in different groups of people. And in the military, our training, our we are trained to perform at a relatively high level. We're exposed to We're deliberately exposed to adversity so that we understand, how our body's going to react and how we need to, what we need to do to keep ourselves, focused and performing at a high level under a
In
lot
those
of
pressure type
stress.
situations.
And so, in my experience, I thought it was just normal. The other thing is, as you know, the literature says that, PTSD needs to present within 6 months or it's considered delayed onset. What we're learning now is that, complex trauma, and that is not a term in the DSM, I don't even, the ICD doesn't, I think in Europe they may recognize, but there's this concept of complex trauma, meaning it's experienced over, and when trauma is experienced over and over again, and what has happened in the last 20 years, I had to think, is 20 years right? But yeah, I'm that old now. I was in the army that long. 20 years, we've been in Iraq, we've been in Afghanistan, we're back in the Middle East, in engaged in warfare now. And so that group that I was a part of that came in around 2000, 2002, I came in 2002. That's that. Now we're starting to see how this complex trauma is presenting, this just constant, unrelent, this constant exposure. And I'll say that you think that I'll give you a great example, intrusive memories, right? One of the, what criterion B or C for a definitive diagnosis. I didn't think.
Many people don't know what you're talking about when you say that criteria B, C, right?
Well, just the things that we use, that have to, the elements that have to be met to diagnose somebody according to the DSM, right? So
Right.
I didn't realize this till 13 sessions into this, my own EMDR therapy, right? And the guy says, "How are the memories?" And I said, "I don't." He said, I said, and then the light bulb went off in my head. I said, "Well, I think about this stuff every day, but it's not like, but I don't crawl up under the bed and, start crying and I'm not non-functional." He says, "That doesn't matter." I said, "Yeah, I mean, I think about these guys that got blown up every day. I think about, what's, I think, I think about Thompson, Staff Sergeant Thompson." I was like, "Man, his kid, his baby, that baby must be 20, 25 years old then." Sergeant Major Blankenbeckler, his kids have grandkids now. They still live around here. And so I'll tell people, in saying all that, what I've found out is one, it presents differently. Two, we're just now starting to learn the effects of this complex trauma, this trauma that's been kind of repeatedly experienced, over time. And that's new to our understanding of PTSD. And then three, you don't, it's not, I mean, it may be your normal, it was my normal, but you don't have to be irritated and feel like you're, somebody, you're constantly under fire or waiting for the next, it's always what if, man. I would get so bent out of shape about a pair of socks being missing, like it was gonna mean but because like, hey, that could get, not having your gear could get you killed. Not having the right gear could result in a serious, incident. And then, so, yeah, it's been eye-opening, but I'm glad to experience the, I'm glad to, I'm proud of my decision to do this and to help others. And it's also eye-opening at how resilient, people are.
Pressure does certain things to certain people. And I think that for most members of our armed services, you are forced in that crucible of training. And a lot of people in the civilian world do not necessarily get that training. And so
No.
pressure does certain things to certain people. It forces some people to snap, and others, it forces others to move towards a solution.
Well, I'll tell you, and it's interesting, and it's, I think this is a good segue into how, pressure or understanding how we perform under pressure, which is what the Army did to us, can be very beneficial. Companies like, the company's, well, it's a game manufacturer. I can't remember. Mattel, was it Mattel? I can't remember. It's the one who, I think it's Mattel. They manufacture a lot of board games. You know what they're doing now with their executives or people that they, that want, that aspire to be an executive or a senior manager within the company? They're putting them through this kind of real world scenario that they've created where they have to make, decisions in real time. It's kind of like a monopoly on steroids, kind of speak. And it's, and then they go through this process, and then afterwards they get to go through and review their, how they performed with somebody. And so I think being exposed to things, and we're learning this now, and there's a lot of therapy, there's a lot of evidence-based therapies that focus on exposure. And how we can and the benefits of being exposed to things, we see that that can vary, it can properly used, it can allow us to perform. And I mean, I look at it in terms of thriving, thrive at a very high level. And I think that's most
Absolutely.
amazing to me. And then, what I look at is, and what I like to look at, because, we see a wide variety of people, right? I like to see and try and understand, hey, why did this person thrive and this person didn't? I like to try, when I have time just on my own to think about that. And I think that, I think Albert Ellis said it best when he said, you have to have unconditional life acceptance. Shit's gonna happen, to say it, to be a
Sure.
little profane. And you saw that through COVID-19. We're, leading a healthcare facility.
Very
So
difficult time.
very difficult. So I guess, what are the three things you would leave us with today that have allowed you to continue to thrive? Because I mean, I know you a little bit, so, and there's lots you didn't talk about, but from my estimation, you really are thriving. So share with us those top three things that you believe have allowed you to continue to thrive in spite of the adversity.
Well, number one is easy. You said it. Understanding it, mastering it is the second component, but it would be mindset. There's so many books on it. Yeah, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, where if you can understand and master your mind being your computer or your processor, it's going to dictate whether or not you have positive or negative feelings. If you can control those positive or negative feelings, it's going to dictate whether or not you have a positive or negative behavior. Those positive and negative behaviors are going to dictate whether or not your legacy is going to be positive or negative. So I would say mindset would be absolutely number one. Number two, we don't use empathy enough. And I think amongst our society, be a man, don't cry is something that is definitely talked about, but not talked about enough. Because loving yourself is something that we are our worst critics, that, there's the old comics where you got the angel on your right shoulder and the devil on your left. That's nothing but your mind. And so it kind of goes in order, but the empathy, loving yourself and telling yourself or affirmations or reaffirming or reframing that you can do anything that you put your mind to, starting back at number one. Those would be my top three.
Well, I appreciate that. I think your comments about mindset really resonated with me, and that's a good place to just remind everybody that, literally, if when we our beliefs turn into thoughts, our thoughts drive feelings, feelings drive emotions, and emotions drive action. And so if we can learn to influence those, and we can learn to understand how our environment is influencing us, we can learn to thrive. And I'll tell you one thing I've learned, and I thought coming into this, I was going to be the Freud guy, the psychodynamic guy with the couch and people come in and lay on it. And you definitely need to understand, how the things that have happened in your life are influencing your decisions, that whole collective unconscious and the shadow self, very important. But, and this is
If I
where
could
I think the business and the business side of both of us and the therapeutic side ties in. But we got to have objectives. We got to have goals, and we need to be making progress, towards those goals. And so I've developed an appreciation for, more solution focused brief therapy. But to the point, like you said, it's mindset. All that was about mindset. And so I appreciate you sharing that with us.
I would like to leave, with a poem. It's called The Bridge Builder by William
Great.
Allen Dromgoole. An old man going a lone highway came at the evening cold and gray to a chasm vast and deep and wide through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fear for him, but he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. Old man said, a fellow pilgrim near, you're wasting your strength with building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again will pass this way. You've crossed this chasm deep and wide. Why build this bridge at evening tide? The builder lifted his old gray head. Good friend, in this path I come, he said. Therefore, followeth after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that I built, naught to me, to that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building this bridge for him. And I feel as clinicians, therapists, that's what we truly are. We're nothing more than bridge builders and just beacons of hope for others.
Well, I thank you for that. Thanks for joining us on episode 5 of the Hero Mindset podcast. I appreciate that, and you brought a lot of value to my community today. And I wish you the best in your future endeavors. Thank you for joining us today.
Likewise, brother. Thank you for having me.